I called this, when Luther called me, I said, how about we do Living in the Steps? And as I did the work to prepare for this, it really turned into this. It's really about the spirituality of the steps. And if it's about the spirituality of the steps, of course, it's about living in the steps and letting the steps live in us. I think you have a right to know this, and we'll talk more about this as we go. But I haven't found any answer other than spirituality, as it is found in the Big Book, as it is practiced through Alcoholics Anonymous, as it is found in the steps. And, you know, I was at a meeting this noon with Bob and the rest, and we talked about a lot of good work, and it was all about me. So what I have learned here is this. I've got to go to God. And what I do has got to come from God consciousness. So that's kind of where this thing is going. I sent Luther a couple of statements, and one of them was, I don't know where I put it, but one of them was, hopefully this will be experiential. I hope to leave enough time that you get time to have little discussion groups and that we can have an AA meeting and you can ask questions, so that I hope when you go home on Sunday that something will have changed inside you that you can take to your work life. Because what use is this if all we do is talk about it? And sometimes we talk and talk and talk, and nothing happens in the place where it should happen. And the book talks about us demonstrating these principles in all our affairs. So, my introduction is this. If you took a primitive out of the jungle, and you showed him a 747 and a horse, and you said you can have either one of these, what do you think he would take? Why? That's what he knows. That's what he's developed the brain cells for. And he would make his choice based on that. And I think that's what the retreat is really about. It's about developing some new brain cells so that instead of taking the horse, I can take the 747. Because we've got this wonderful program. And I find many times I struggle still way too much. I still get into things, and so do my sponsees, and I do a lot of counseling, and I hear it from other people. We're still in difficulties, and I think sometimes we choose the horse instead of the 747, and hopefully the retreat will give us some insight. You know, we're not going to get the help from CNN. You're not going to get the help from Cosmopolitan Magazine. You're not going to get the help from magazines and newspapers and movies and whatever else. That's not their business. Their business is to promote another way of life. And so we're caught in the race consciousness. And I'm not impressed with the race consciousness. We're still at a place where we make war. We're still at a place where in the last century we killed over 100 million people, as the numbers have come out of the United Nations. We're told that every day 25 or 30,000 children die of malnutrition and disease. And this in a world that is as abundant and full of goodness as our world is, and yet we allow that to happen. You know, we live in a world where somebody talks about forgiveness on public television and gets booed off a stage. So, we're part of that. 6.8 billion of us. You know, Carl Jung had many things to say about that, about this idea of the race consciousness. And sometimes when I look at my life and I think how difficult it feels, I think 6.8 billion of us. You know, Carl Jung had many things to say about that, about this idea of the race consciousness. And sometimes when I look at my life and I think how difficult it feels, I think it's like this. To live this spiritual way, it's like pulling you out of molasses that is the race consciousness, the old way of thinking. To think different and to act different, that takes something. So I remember Eric Butterworth, he used to say, we're not here to set it right, we're here to see it right. And many years ago, Chuck Chamberlain was one of my teachers. And he used to say this all the time. He'd say, Mildred, stop being so critical. When people see better, they will do better. And I really believe that. So, why am I taking this approach? Well, take a look at the language of the big book. I've just taken a few of the statements out of the big book. We have been rocketed into the fourth dimension. You can't throw that aside and say it doesn't matter. What does it mean? You know, later on in the book it says, we have entered the world of the spirit. He says, spiritual principles would solve all my problems. You know, if you're sitting there, you're having relationship problems, you're having sex problems, nobody has those these days, we're having money problems, whatever is happening, and somebody comes along and says, spiritual principles will solve that. Do you believe that? I do. There is no other way to solve them. But a lot of learning and a lot of changing has to go on. I remember the first time I had no home, I had nothing. And I heard this, and, you know, I said something which I wouldn't repeat. About this business that spiritual principles would egg me on, really, at 51 years. Shame on you. And then there's the statement, either God is everything or nothing. And he says the day will come when faced, you know, your head will be in a vice by the experiences of life that you're having. This isn't about pouring pink paint over our lives. And it isn't about trying to pretend that life is something else. Like I said last night, I'm not one of those who says, well, you know, I got sober and it just gets better and better and better. I have had days in sobriety where I have been screaming with pain, where the best I could do would be to curl up in the fetal position. I'm glad you're nodding. Because, you know, crawl into the fetal position, keep breathing, and maybe put one foot ahead of the other and get through it until some of that pain passes. There's nothing here that says we're going to be exempt from life. And then, of course, we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing here? Are we here to make money? Are you here to have a big house? Are you here to have the corner office and make $500,000 a year or God knows how much you make? Is that what the purpose is? See, three of the most important questions I was told are these. Who am I? What am I doing here? And where am I going? We'll talk about those. So, either God is everything or nothing. And then he says, this is what the book is about. And it will help us find the power that will solve your problem. And the first time my sponsor had read that, I said problems, because I had problems. And he said, read it again. And finally I saw there was no S. And he said, what is your problem? And then he had me look at page 62. And it says right there, the root of the problem is self. And Chuck Chamberlain used to hammer it home to me. He'd say, Mildred, you think your problem is drinking alcohol. Your problem is you think you're separate from God. And everything that's going on in your life and that has happened is based on that. And at the time, I didn't really understand that. And then there's that marvelous statement on page 164. See, either this stuff means something or throw the book away. It says, see to it that your relationship with God is right, and then great things will come to pass for you and countless others. And I have to tell you, I have found that to be true. To the degree that my relationship with God is right, and that does not mean what I thought when I first read it, that it was following the dictates of a church. And if the church said, this is what you must do, and I did all those things, I'd be okay. It's rather what's going on in here in relationship with my God. Chuck used to say, Mildred, you already are everything that you can be. And you know everything that you could know. If you know Chuck's history, you know that he had studied spirituality in depth. And that's why he could say, you already are everything. If God is within us, if that great reality is deep within us, then we already are everything. But you see, if we go to the race consciousness, then we're going to think, I don't have a big enough house, and I don't have that much money, and I don't look good, and I'm getting old, and this is the problem, and I've got all kinds of things, and my relationship is the pits, and God knows what's happening, you see. And Chuck used to say, you already are everything that you can be. We'd put the self-esteem therapists out of business, wouldn't we, if we really believed that. Einstein, he said, there's only one of us here. So however many people are here tonight, there's only one of us here. He was talking about the great reality. And the scientists, if you take a look and study what some of the great scientists who have won Nobel Peace Prizes, what they have said, they've all said the same thing, that there's a great reality and everything flows out of it. Some of them don't call it God. I remember one time hearing Stephen Hawking being interviewed by Larry King. And Larry asked him, he said, do you believe in God? And Stephen Hawking hesitated a moment. And then he said, if by God you mean the God of the churches, he said, no. If by God you mean that great reality out of which everything flows, he said, of course I believe that. And that kind of is what a lot of these great scientists have said. I didn't bring a lot of my papers because I already had a suitcase full of stuff, but Einstein also said there is no matter. So take a look at these. Take a look at what you're sitting on. What is this world? See? The world is very different, I think, than what I always thought it was. And those questions challenge me every day. Who am I? What am I doing here? Where am I going? See? Meister Eckhart put it this way. Meister Eckhart was a mystic of the 12th, 13th century. And he said, the soul grows by subtraction. CNN won't tell you that. And neither will any of the corporate structures that want us to buy. They're not going to tell you that. The soul grows by subtraction. But I must say, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have stuff. I don't think that's what it means. I think it means that our business is to die daily. I don't think Alcoholics Anonymous is just about not drinking alcohol. I think it is about that business of dying daily to the old man. And that's what all the great spiritual teachers have said, so that we can be reborn in this new way of living. And now that I'm saying it, it's right in step 3, isn't it? Where it says we have a new employer who provides everything we need if we, you know, do his work well. And it says, and if we take this attitude, we are reborn. You know, I went back over some of my notes, and you know, the early AAs, they talked a lot about conversion. Our whole business started through, you know, Bookman and Sam Shoemaker. And, you know, Sam Shoemaker was in China. And he was supposed to be a missionary, and nobody was listening to him. And so when Frank Bookman, who was the founder of the Oxford Group, when he came, Sam went to him and said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I'm trying to pass a spiritual message, and nobody's listening to me." And Sam said, "I want you to go." Frank said, "I want you to go tonight and check out what's going on inside you that explains why the Chinese are not listening." And the next day, Sam came back to Frank and he said, "I found out." He said, "I hate the Chinese." That would be a fairly good reason. And he had a conflict with one fellow, apparently, who was kind of the leader of the people who came. So Frank gave him a process to do to get rid of what was inside. And if you read, they read that book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And my friend Jay Stinnett does a wonderful PowerPoint presentation, only he calls it The Varieties of Spiritual Experience, and he goes through a lot of the experiences that people had in the early days where they had those conversions, where whatever was blocking God's grace from moving them to do what it was, that from changing them, that they had these experiences. You know, if you look at Roland, for example, Carl Jung said, "I have no success with people of your type." He said, "You need a vital spiritual experience. I don't know how to produce it." You know, it's wonderful to see. And then he took the message, Roland. He said, going to church, I'm paraphrasing, doesn't provide the necessary spiritual experience. Go back to New York and find a church where you can be of service. And that's what Roland did. And then he found Ebby up north in their summer homes. And he took Ebby when Ebby was going to go to jail, and he helped Ebby. And Ebby then came to New York, and Ebby got involved in the movement there in the Oxford group, and they were trying to pass the message. They were trying to practice early Christianity is what they were really doing. And then it was Ebby who brought the message to Bill. So I just love those stories. And it brings me to the whole subject of spirituality. I have to tell you, as I stand here, I came here kind of like an animal, not to Las Vegas, but to the program. I've gotten off my four hoofs. And I have to tell you that if I think about everything that has happened to me, I would be a liar if I said there was not a power at work in my life that has done for me what I couldn't do for myself, and that I have had to come to terms with a God of my experience, not a God of my understanding. And that's why I stand here. And I'm going to start by talking about, I just went through the book and I took 8, there are lots more, expressions of spirituality. What does spirituality, what is it really about? It's of the spirit. It's that part of our lives that is not accessible to the 5 senses. You can't see it, you can't smell it, and so on. And it's not also accessible to the intellect. We can think about it, but to grow spiritually, the intellect can't help us. It's a soul job. It's between God and my soul. The intellect, I can read books, but that isn't going to change what's going on in here. It will change me if I use what I learned and change my behavior and change my thinking and change the way I do business on the planet. So what does the book say about spirituality? In the introduction to the 12 and 12, he says, we have here a set of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, enable the sufferer to live free of the disease and to be useful and to live a whole life. I'm paraphrasing. In the chapter to the agnostics, He says, if you find that you want to quit and you can't stay quit, or you find that you can't stop entirely, you may be suffering from a disease which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Anybody go to their doctor and the doctor said, hey, you need a spiritual experience? You'd have fallen right under the chair, wouldn't you? Imagine, we suffer from a disease which only a spiritual experience will conquer. I'm starting to think that maybe every disease is that way, but that's another day. Number three, he says these are not easy alternatives to face, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. See? And then he says, you had to face the fact we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Then we have what Carl Jung said, that we have had vital... I better get the book. Because it's right in front of me. Page 27. Where he says, here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena, and he goes on to describe that. On page 25, he says, we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences that have revolutionized our whole attitude to life, to our fellows, and to God's universe. And then in the appendix, he talks about the spiritual experience, and he says, we've had a vast change in feeling and outlook, a profound alteration in our reaction to life. And then look at step 12. You know, step 12 doesn't promise us a big house. It doesn't promise us, a holiday in the Caribbean. It promises us a spiritual awakening. So what is that all about? What I wanted to lay the foundation for is that this emphasis on the spiritual, you know, I hear people say, well, God isn't mentioned in all the steps. God doesn't have to be mentioned in all the steps. That whole concept that we need to change spiritually and then the outside will change, it's there almost on every page. So step 12 says we need a spiritual awakening. I thought a lot about this business of waking up. What do we wake up to? And if I need to wake up, the implication is I've been asleep. Now, supposing somebody has been there on a cot or in a chair and has been asleep since we began, that person would have heard nothing. That person could be sitting there and somebody could come in and say, I have a check for $1 million and the first one that comes will get the check. That person would not be available to that because they are asleep. If we're physically asleep, we're not aware of opportunities. We're not aware of danger. We're not aware of what's going on around us. And if we're spiritually asleep, we're not aware of what's going on around us spiritually. And I can tell you, you can be in a convent and you can hear lots of stuff and hear absolutely nothing. Because if you're spiritually asleep and you can't hear, you can't hear. So, the book says God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. He says also we insist on that you enjoy life. I don't think that says, you know, just come and park your hiney and you're going to be happy, joyous, and free. God wants it. You know, if you have children, you may want your children to be successful, but if they don't fulfill the conditions for success, then that isn't going to happen. So, the great master, when he was here, he understood this. He said, they have eyes to see and see not, and they have ears to hear and they hear not. And I think that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous too. So I'd like to talk a little bit about this thirst. You know, I think it's the thirst that drives us to spiritual awakening. And I think it's the thirst that drives us also to drink the way we do. Chuck used to say to me, and I didn't understand it at the time, but I have a much better grip on it now. He used to say, we're no different than anybody else. God didn't create two classes of people. But for us, as alcoholic, we've run out of time. See, I don't think that there are two people in the same place spiritually. We don't know that, but I don't think that, you know, if you could measure everybody's spiritual growth, you know there are people who are quite happy to be asleep. And you know there are people who are very much awake and want to keep growing. Isn't that true? But he used to say for alcoholics, that's what he thought. And at the time, I didn't understand. He said he thought that we had run out of time. He meant that we'd run out of time of doing it the old way. And so I went looking for what is this thirst that we experience. You know, when you see something that is repeated and repeated in human nature, it kind of gives you the idea that it's in all of us. And so, in the 5,000 years ago, there was Isaiah. And Isaiah was shouting to the people, wake up, wake up, get up, and put on your beautiful garments. That's 5,000 years ago. The implication being, man is asleep. And then come the Greeks. And above their porticos, they used to have the sign, man, wake up. And I used to think, in my great wisdom, that they had it wrong. I used to think that they should say, man, know your God. Well, I guess they're kind of the same, in a sense. Because you're not going to know your God until you wake up. And then there's that psalm in the Bible that says, as a deer pants for water, so my soul pants for thee, O Lord. And then there's St. Augustine, the bad boy of the third century. And in his book, The City of God, he writes, thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and our hearts are restless. You see this continuing theme throughout. And then there's Francis Thompson, a little more contemporary. He was one of us. He lived from 1859 to 1907, and he wrote that fabulous poem, The Hound of Heaven. Do you know that one? In which he pictures God chasing the soul. I'll just read you a little bit of it. It's written in somewhat archaic language, but he still gets the point across. He says, I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. And when God caught up to him, he said, all things betray thee who betrayest me. And in response, Francis Thompson says, my harness, he's talking about his shell, piece by piece, you have hewn from me and smitten me to my knees. I am defenseless utterly. Isn't that really what we experience through this process? I want to drink alcohol. I want to solve my life's problems that way. And God, and he says, I slept and woke to find me totally stripped in sleep. And God says to him, all I did take from thee, I took for thy harms, but that I took not for thy harms, but that thou mightest seek it in my arms. All that you fancy lost, I have stored for thee at home. Rise, take my hand, and come. That's the promise of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the promise of the spiritual awakening. A more contemporary songwriter wrote this, poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world on his lonely way back home. See that theme of going home? It's in so many places. How many songs have been written with this theme, I want to go home? For some people, that's not a great idea. Home was not a safe place. But the concept of home, where you can go and you're loved, and they love you and you love them, and you're safe there, and you're nurtured and you're looked after, that's what we're talking about. And then there's that wonderful song by Peggy Lee, where she says, "Is that all there is? And if it is, then I better keep dancing, because what I've gotten so far isn't filling the hole in my soul." If you look at the art and music and literature, it's there again. Those themes of restlessness and longing and thirsting. We're not the only people who have ever been restless, irritable, and discontent. And that was what Dr. Silkworth saw. He said, we're restless, irritable, and discontent until we again experience the peace and ease that come from taking a few drinks. I don't think we were ever meant to quiet the restless, irritable discontent, to quiet the longing by making it go away. I think we were meant to experience that so-called emptiness, that longing. And by the way, I don't think there's an emptiness. I think if God is here, that's an impossibility. I think that that's why the theme of asleepness is so big, because we're asleep to who it is that we truly are. And so we feel empty and think, you have to fill me so that I'll be okay. And, you know, our psychologists, some of the people that I used to think really knew what they were talking about, they've said, our greatest need is to be loved. Ever hear that? You might as well write victim across your forehead if you think that. Because if your greatest need is to be loved, you better go looking. And isn't that what a lot of us have done? Instead of waking up and understanding what Chuck knew so well, that it is within us. And Chuck used to say another thing, what you want to experience, you must express. You see? If I want to experience love, I must express love. You see, and then you begin to know it is within me, because I couldn't express it if I didn't have it within me. And then this famous saying of Carl Jung, he said he believed that the craving for alcohol in us was the equivalent on a low level of our being for wholeness. And he said it much more plainly in the letter to Bill Wilson when he was responding when AA was 25 years old. He said, I couldn't say it when I knew Roland Hazard, but he said his soul was thirsting for union with God. Pretty strong language. And in those days, he said, of course, he wouldn't have dared say that. So, So, we've talked about the concept of spirituality. We've talked about how many times that idea is brought up in the big book. And we've talked about this thirst that mankind seems to have. So, what goes wrong? Like, where do we find ourselves? As somebody explained it to me, we come in a two-in-one package. A body and a soul, let's say. The way we're raised, most of us, we're not taught a whole lot about what our spirits are doing. We're taught about how to get along in the physical world. Isn't that right? This is how you do it. You get a good education, and we learn from the way we see our mamas and papas acting how we are supposed to do life and how we're going to get along and what is going to make us okay. I've asked a lot of people this. Did your mama and papa, and it's not to criticize them, it's where we are in the race consciousness. Get along on the outside and you'll be okay. Kind of that's the message. Isn't that what you got? A lot of you? Yes? And you know it doesn't work, and I know it doesn't work. So we show up in this body, which doesn't last very long. And we think that if we can just make things on the outside to suit us, we'll be okay. And we wind up, as the Course in Miracles says, living in a dry and dusty world where starved and thirsty creatures come to die. We live in a dry and dusty world where starved and thirsty creatures come to die. You know, think about your life. I identify with that. The world, that's the way the world felt to me. And I was always looking for the next thrill, the next thing, the next something that was going to make it okay. And then, of course, when you find alcohol, you're off and running. But, you see, the thing is, we chase a lot of stuff, don't we? We chase power. We chase power in its various forms. For some of us, it's money. For some of it's property. For some of us, it's prestige. For some of us, it's we want powerful friends. For some of us, it's houses and it's cars and all the trappings that seem to indicate I'm somebody. But it never lasts. I always think of a pair of brown loafers I got when I was about 7 years old. Kind of the story of my life. My mother bought me these brown loafers. And, you know, I had a lot of older brothers and sisters, so you wore a lot of hand-me-downs. So those new shoes really meant something to me. And life was good. I'd look at those shoes, I'd put those shoes on, I'd go to school, and nothing could go wrong. Absolutely nothing. I'd put them under the bed. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I'd look under the bed and there were the brown loafers. And I was happy. And I'd go back to sleep. And one day, the inevitable happened. I looked at the brown loafers and they were just shoes. They had lost the shine. They had lost the ability to take me to that place of happiness. And that's about been the story of my life, you know, with getting stuff and buying stuff and achieving stuff and all that acquiring business. The amazing thing about this is, when you get right with God, you can enjoy that stuff if you're not attached to it. If you're trying to use that stuff to be somebody, to get people to notice you, you know, it's such a losing ball game. You know, I remember after I got sober and I started eventually to buy houses and I made a lot of money and I had my own house built. And I remember thinking, when I get this house built, they're really going to know who I am. I'm going to become the mother of AA in Aurora. They're going to come to my house. The meeting was on Sunday night, and they're going to come to my house, and I'm going to bake cinnamon buns, and, you know, I have this big pot, and I'm going to make coffee, and they're all going to want to come to my house. I had a plan. I was going to be somebody, and they were going to know how wonderful I was in my big house and all that kind of stuff. You know what happened? I lived there for 5 years, and I went to one meeting the night before I moved in, and I never went to another meeting there in the 5 years because my life basically was still downtown Toronto. And I went to a meeting the night after I had moved out. And no meetings in between, and I never became the mother of AA in Aurora. And, you know, I said to somebody, you know, if I bought the house with that intention, I sure blew it. So I'll just tell you a little bit about my experience with these steps, so you know where I am coming from indeed. Before I do that, I want to ask you, how does your life feel right now? You think about your life. Don't have to respond. Is there anybody in your life that is troublesome to you? Is there anybody you think you'd like to change? Oh, really? You want to name some? Are there situations that if you had the power to do so, if you had a magic wand, that you would change? See, there is a way for our lives to get better, but it isn't with the magic wand. And so, I didn't know all that. When I got sober in 1973, I was on a park bench at that time. My husband, I had married my psychiatrist. That's not too smart a thing to do. And we had lost everything. He drank, and we lost everything. And so I spent the last 3 weeks of my drinking career on a park bench. And I the morning of May the 20th, I was in a psych ward. Somebody had picked me off the park bench. And the compulsion and the obsession were taken from me. That's all I can say. They didn't slip away, and there was nobody there who talked me out of it. I was on my way to commit suicide, and something happened like that, and the compulsion was taken. And I spent the first year of my sobriety on Skid Row. I spent the first 6 months sweeping a factory floor. And I'd finish that, and I'd go back to my room on Skid Row, and then I'd go and sweep the factory floor. I had no contacts except the psychiatrist, not my husband, the other guy, at the institution where I had been in the hospital. He was my one thread of hope to the real world. And after 6 months, I came to AA, and by a real God shot, and got a sponsor, and that whole process began. And my first sponsor got drunk, and two guys took me through the steps, and they said, you are too sick to be able to stay here if you don't do the steps. And they took me through the steps, and something changed in me. The big change was this. I realized for the first time in my life, I was 41 years old, and for the first time in my life, I realized I was the problem. To blame everybody. The church, the Pope, Mother Superior, you name it, I had an excuse for why I was. It was your fault that I was the way I was. And when I look at it, you know, that's how I started out that day. Every time I've done the steps, there has been a gift. I got the debts paid off. And, you know, I'll just cut to the chase. The first 20 years, I think I learned to do life. Because I started drinking when I was 5, and I didn't learn to do life. All I learned was, because that's where my strength is my intellect. I learned how to, you know, do teaching. I learned how I could read. I could do all kinds of things, but I didn't grow in relationship. I didn't grow in spirituality. You know, and that's saying something for somebody who's been 15 years in a convent. You can have a head full of theology, and nothing's going on in here, and nothing was going on in here. And when people talked about God, when I came, I mean, I heard what I heard. I heard as much as I could hear, and that's all I could hear. And I don't think much of it seeped into my soul. And rather, I was listening to the old voices that said, you're a nobody, you're nothing, you'll never amount to anything, nobody cares about you. And that goes right back, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. At 20 years, I gave up the boyfriend and I gave up my job, and that's when I was plunged into a real depression. And I had no idea how where my life was going. And talk about a power that guides us. I got a phone call about 3 weeks after this from Father O'Brien. And he said, I'd like you to come to the Jesuit house and give a retreat. And, you know, it takes what it takes. I said, Father, I've been excommunicated so often, I don't think you want me. And he said, I don't care about that. He said, I want you to come. And I went and I gave a retreat to 70 women. And the morning I finished that retreat, this is really why I'm telling you this. I stood in front of those 70 women and I started to bawl. Not pretty like they do in the movies. I bawled. I don't cry in front of women. I shed strategic tears before men. I'm good at that. I know how to do that, but bawl in front of women? No, thank you. But I did. And I couldn't have stopped it. And I heard myself say, I don't have a friend in the world. I have lots of acquaintances, but I don't have a friend in the world. I felt close to nobody. You can't build up the walls that I had built up and make friends. It's impossible. And it felt to me as if God, if the time was ready, and those walls just went whoosh, and they were gone. They were gone. And that's when the real growth process started. I felt like a chicken. I had no protection. A chicken without feathers. The real me showed up, and that's what you're getting now. You get the real me, not somebody who's trying to pretend to be something. This is the process that I went through, and that's when I started to grow. And that's when somebody came into my path who talked to me about those old ideas. And he called it the bondage of self. And I heard that, and I was able to do something, to take some actions that Bill talks about in Step 8 in the 12 and 12, where he says, you know, we've had these things that have been buried. I didn't understand all that stuff, you know, and so this has been a real process for me. So the last 15 years, they have been absolutely, completely different. I have been open to hear. I have been open to grow. I have been open to change and to start to experience the goodness of my life. I remember those days when I was buying and selling houses. I'm a teacher, but I was teaching, but I was also buying and selling houses and making a lot of money, and then built my own house. It meant nothing to me. There was always an agenda. If, you know, if they know how much money I have, if I can go first class, if I can have the big house and they can see, then they're going to know who I am. No sense of identity, no sense of this spirituality. You know, when I think about this, I would say to you, I think that our souls grow, yeah, by subtraction. And our souls grow by the grace of God. You know, sometimes people come to me and they'll say, you know, Mildred, you've gone through it. Will you take down my walls? And my answer is absolutely not. Because those walls are defense mechanisms. And if you are fragile inside, you need those defense mechanisms. See, I don't think I'm on the planet to be good. And I don't think I'm on the planet to be a great retreat director. I don't think I'm on the planet to make a lot of money or whatever. I think I'm on the planet to become totally dependent on God. That's what those steps take us to. They take us from that powerlessness to the place where we wake up spiritually and realize who we truly are. That indeed, we're made out of God. If the book is correct, and where he says, either God is everything or nothing, if God is everything, That's the only thing we could be made out of. And if that's what I'm made out of, then my whole purpose, I think, is to fulfill that by starting to think correctly, think the way God would have me think, act the way God would have me act, speak the way God would have me act. And isn't that our program? And I never saw all of that. But you see, the other thing I guess that I would say before we take a little break is this. You can't push growth. I'm not going to apologize for the fact of what I've just told you. You know, and say, well, I should have grown faster. No, I shouldn't have. I grew just at the right pace. God never makes a mistake. And I don't think that, you know, I sometimes think, if I met different people, then I would have grown faster. That's just an illusion. You know, the book talks about the fact that we live in illusion and we live in delusion, doesn't it? And that's one of them. And it's all about the ego. You know, then I'd look better. Then I'd have a different story. This is my story. This is how this whole thing happened to me. And in the process, what I really have come to believe is that God is everything and everything that flows from that. I'm going to finish this little piece with, I went back over the book, and the book tells us what won't work. Middle-of-the-road solutions. Frothy emotional appeal. Human power. Personal power. Willpower. Self-knowledge. Fear. Managing well. The book says we thought we could wrest satisfaction out of this world if only we managed well. I have a different version of that. I thought I could wrest satisfaction out of the world if I did the hard thing and went to a convent. And that was a bust. Jeez. Failing to enlarge our spiritual life. And then this is the one Carl Jung said of Roland. He said, while religious convictions were very good, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. I think we had to be knocked to our knees before that vital spiritual experience, and that, of course, takes us right to step one. And why not? Why don't those methods work? Because we have placed ourselves beyond human aid. Because we have a peculiar mental twist. Because we have a strange mental blank spot. I can have a blank, I used to have a blank spot about drinking alcohol. I have, in sobriety, had some strange mental blank spots about all kinds of things like men and money and sex and all kinds of things. Hello there. Did you come in to hear about sex? We're just getting right to it. You're a good-looking one, too. Jeez. Do you like older women? Okay. Two more reasons why they don't work. Prejudice and old ideas. Then he says, what will work? Sex. No, not really. You got it on my brain now. He says, we need a vital spiritual experience. Vital. That's why living in the steps, not just listening to this stuff. Where does it hit you? Where do you have to apply it? I know where I have to apply it. He says we need an entire psychic change, not just a half-assed entire psychic change, an entire psychic change. He says spiritual principles would solve all our problems. Some days I don't want to hear this. I want to get at it with my own methods. Then he says when the spiritual malady is overcome, that comes first, then we straighten out in other ways. I already said, see to it that your relationship with God is right and great things will come to pass. Right in the middle of a talk, a handsome young man walks in. Whoa! I think we're ready for a break. How how long? 10 minutes? 15 minutes? Huh? 15? Okay. Do we have a bell to ring, or will we just assemble the troops? Or will you just kind of keep an eye? 10 after 8?